session number 11212, reel 14.
Colonel R.B. Humphreys, Reel 14. As a staff officer, Colonel, what were the types of duties that you had to carry out?
I was right-hand man to Colonel Ware for visits to his units under his command and go with him on recces to see how one could improve the image from out to sea. The Germans would see camouflage and all kinds of things like that. We had a car, staff car, and there was an MTO and an intelligence officer. And we built this headquarters down in the cellars, battle headquarters, and really, by that time, the Blitz was starting, the Battle of Britain. And the sands were focused on as a very likely place if they were going to come and land. So we had a lot of attention from the government, Churchill and generals and people. As I say, the Blitz started. We didn't see as much of it, of course, as Sussex and over the Channel. The Battle of Britain. Well, we saw quite a bit of it. Planes going away and everything. And,
were you attacked by bombers at all? Were you attacked by
aircraft? No, we weren't. Now, Torquay was completely Air Force, training Air Force, cadets mostly, and they had, with the Home Guard, they had the defence of Torquay. And beyond, there was another brigade of another regiment, of another division. Well, we were independent brigade. Then 50th Division were further down towards Devon and Cornwall, holding the beaches there.
What was the quality of reinforcements you were getting, because the 11th Battalion had been through a pretty bad time?
Yes, a lot of them weren't Durham people at all. A lot of them were drafts from all kinds of regiments.
Had any of them seen action in France?
Mm-hmm.
Had any of those people seen action in France and had got back?
Some had just got back, and others were brand new from being called up or joining up.
So carrying out this patrolling and this activity, how difficult was it to also train them and whip them into shape?
Oh, well, it took quite a time. Oh, yes, it took quite a time. That's what the companies were doing in the battalion I'd left. And they, as I say, Colonel Ware had this battalion, plus this Denbury docks group under his command, right up to the Brixham, where the LDV and they did help there, and also right round to Dartmouth, where they joined up with the Navy. And then Brigadier Kirkup took on from Dartmouth right along to Slapton, right along to Hope Cove, Kingsbridge. And he had a reserve, Tyneside Scottish, and he had the 10th Battalion and the part of the 11th Battalion on that side.
What was the equipment situation, Colonel?
Oh, very bad.
And was it getting better gradually?
Very gradually. Issued of the odd army trucks and then the anti-tank guns and things, very few. an awful lot of deception was being done. Old vehicles, old guns, Crimea guns from Sandhurst were brought down and put on the beaches and camouflaged. And camouflage was going up rather haphazardly because there were LDV officers working with the sort of regular officers to lay things out. And as the battle got worse, Battle of Britain, an invasion seemed to be nearing. Of course, things were thrown up, all kinds of things. For instance, loos on the front of the seafront were camouflaged into making them look like loos, and they had men stuck in them looking out to sea and that sort of thing. And we, the worst of the height of the battle, we went down to our battle headquarters and we spent 3 nights down there standing by. And the whole of the sector was standing by. Nothing happened. Mines were laid along the Stapton Sands rather haphazardly. One or two went up with black dogs standing on them. The hotel was blown to bits, but no one was hurt, luckily. And the Lee, you know, it has a Lee. Stapton's behind the Lee. It was all sort of reinforced in front. And, well,
one... What was the accommodation that you were living in?
We were living in a private house. The soldiers were living generally either in tents or caravan sites, all kinds of places, pubs. No barracks or anything down there. Absolutely none. And then the Blitz started on Plymouth, of course. We saw that going up one night. And the Blitz started on Exeter. Torquay was spared. It didn't have any Blitz. But Swansea and places like that inland had blitzed, were badly blitzed. London was being blitzed, and the country was at war with Germany, no doubt about it.
How long were you with Colonel Ware in a staff officer?
Well, come the Battle of Britain over, and we'd won the Air Force part, we were ordered as a brigade to go to Iceland. So we withdrew about, I think it was, beginning of October, to Denbury. And our place was taken by other units. Rather less trained units that had just formed. And we concentrated to go to Iceland. And then from there we went to Iceland and sailed about November to be a part of the Iceland force. There were two brigades of 49 Div there already. They got there just in time before the Germans got there. Of course, it was to guard the Atlantic charter, the Atlantic route. A lot of naval activity going on all over the place. The Battle of the River Plate had taken place down in southern seas, and the one or two things had been sunk, the Royal Oak. And,
how were you received in Iceland, do you recall?
Yes. We got there last, so we received with dumb hostility. They've never had an occupying force. They never had an army in their lives. And they're dumb hostility. Why should people come and invade our country? And, of course, the general, 49th General Curtis, was a very diplomatic man, and he was able to point out that if we hadn't come, the Germans would. Which were quite right, they would have done. Anyhow, they got to like us in the end, we got to like them. But they're a very impassive nation, completely peaceful, and hated any occupation by soldiers of any race, whatever, or air force. And we went to them. Our brigade went to the area around Reykjavik, about 16 miles out. We went to a place called Elafoss on the lava rock. No trees, very bad roads. And then the 10th Battalion went further around the coast on our right and up to Borgarnes. They had a rather more northern company detached from the others. And the Tyneside Scottish were in reserve by headquarters, Div headquarters at Salmon River, which was a river running up between Elafoss and Reykjavik.
Can you tell me, Colonel, the kind of conditions in which the men and the officers were living in Iceland?
We were in Nissen huts. It was very rough conditions, bare amount of blankets and things, and the terrain round was no trees whatever, all lava rock, and a lot of peasants' farms, and little village of Alafossi had a few shops. And then our duties really were to patrol, to keep alert, and to see that the camp was run, which was quite a feat because it wasn't like any normal camp, easy to run. And we did some training on the desert, on the lava rock. Roads were more or less non-est. And it was a difficult station to be stationed there.
In what ways was the camp difficult to run as against a normal camp?
It wasn't all that difficult to run against a normal camp. But it was just things were, well, much less sophisticated. We had running through the camp a hot water system that was going to heat the whole of Reykjavik, coming from a geyser, and it was sulfur water. And in the mornings, it flowed down, and it was boiling hot water, and your batman could just go across from your tent, which is 50 yards away, dip a bucket in, and he was shaved in it, but of course you didn't drink it. And rations were all tinned or very little fresh stuff. A lot of TB about with the locals. And
did this affect any of the health of the soldiers and yourselves?
Not really.
In the situation in which you were living, Colonel, in Iceland, was leisure a problem?
In a way, because there were very few things like football. The troops wanted to play fields because they were all lava rock. And also there was not much time for leisure, really, because of patrolling and things like that. Boredom did come into it a bit, there's no doubt about it. Patrols every night and a lot of night work and perhaps a little sleep. And then one went out on motor patrols and joining up with the other battalion on your right, the 10th Battalion, along the coastline. Now, there's plenty to do. And then, of course, there were a lot of casualties coming in from ships at sea, and we heard of people being sunk and things. Then the Atlantic Charter came, and Churchill came and reviewed the troops and reviewed the situation generally. And there was quite a lot of focus on Iceland, but only one casualty while I was there, and that was some Stukas came down and shot up a column coming from church on a Sunday morning and killed a sergeant at the bank. That was all.
Were there many air raids at all from the Germans?
Well, one or two air raids, yes. Oh, yes, there were only one or two air raids.
Were you building any defences?
Oh, yes, yes.
And what form did they take?
All the way along the coast. Well, some down near the coast, others set back in reserve. The idea of reserve had come in, and the sort of more normal conception of warfare had come in. And the other brigades were the same. One was right up in the north, and the other brigade was round Reykjavik on the other side of us. We relieved it later, and they came to our position. Then Reykjavik was held by part of that brigade, and as I say, what little reserve they had. Tyneside Scottish Wind Reserve.
What was the effect of the climate? Because it would change, no doubt, did it, during the year?
Yes, well, we were there beginning of the winter, and it was getting very cold. We had special clothing, and also the nights were getting very long and the days very short. So the result was we had little time to sort of see our training. We did a lot of night training.
What form did that take, Colonel?
Well, patrolling mostly. Patrolling and night attacks across the lava rock. As I say, the roads were non-est. Really. Div commander was just down the road with his div headquarters, and the brigadier was near him, our brigadier. Then...
You said you had special clothing. What kind of clothing was that?
Well, they had big fur-lined boots and very heavy overcoats. Not the same as Tintin, not as bad as Tintin, but very long overcoats. Rather made people immobile, even if they had to patrol. And sentries had to have their guns, rifles ready, but it was difficult to keep warm as a sentry. There was a lot of patrolling up and down this pipeline towards Reykjavik.
How cold did it get in the depths of winter?
Oh, very cold. Not as cold as Greenland, but very cold. It was very cold.
And could men do a normal...
I mean, people could lie out at night and get frozen to death.
I was going to ask you, could a man do a normal guard duty outside for whatever 2 hours he might have done in England, 4 hours, whatever it was in England? Could they do it in Iceland in the middle
of the day? Well, they did about an hour. And as I say, you're walking about most of the time to keep warm. And we did have one or two cases of people freezing to death. Also, there was quite a lot of rum ration given out on really cold nights. Then came the shortest day of the year. And, of course, in the summer, the midnight sun came, the longest day, and it never got dark at all. And it was quite mild in the summer.
Was there a lot of snow and snowstorms?
Quite a lot of snow, blizzards.
Did that create any problems for you? Did they create any problems for you?
Apart from transport.
No one got lost in these?
Not many, no. One or two patrols did get lost, but they always came back. Up in the north was one that got lost that didn't come back at the KOLI, and they found 14 men frozen to death in the snow. That was right in the north of the island, the other brigade. We had one or two scares when the carrier officer went out with his platoon, and he got lost for 2 days, but they did find them all, and none of them died. Then we had a place called Thingvetla we used to go and train out at, which is about 16 miles from Alafoss. And that was the seat of the old parliament. And there were a few tiny trees, stunted trees, a forest. Forest of Thingvetla had been striving for an existence for thousands of years, 1,000 years older, parliament was. And it was about the size of, about 3 or 4 acres. It was called a forest. There was a big pub there because they, before the war, it was a tourist attraction. But it was lava rock the whole way. And a nasty journey out.
As the population warmed to you, did they take troops into their homes?
Oh, yes. They were good like that. And the soldiers, British soldiers, always good. He sort of wooed them. But it wasn't a pleasant place to be stationed. Because there was a sort of feeling of frustration. You weren't in the middle of things. And yet you were doing a very vital job, you knew. But you hadn't got much excitement. The battalion was well trained, I think. He was a very good trainer, Colonel Ware. And he had set programs and everything. And then different people were ordered to do different other jobs. And so we went on until we had Christmas at Alafoss. And then we moved after Christmas and took over from another brigade of 49 Div who came to our area, and we went into their area, which was the other side of Reykjavik, a place called Hafnarfjörður. And that was rather different kind of country because it was nearer the sea and lava rock running right down to the sea. And it was on the way to Keflavik, which was the air station for Iceland, and also the place where they had these flying boats. And then the Americans entered the war, of course, and all hell was let loose about Singapore that year in 1941, it would be then. Hong Kong, not Singapore. And, of course, Russia, on the 10th of June, had turned over to our side. So the Germans did have a... looking both ways then.
Was there any great change in your life and conditions moving to that other position?
No, except that the summer was coming, and it was getting lighter and lighter and lighter. Terrific smell of fish. They love fish. The Icelandics on all the rocks. And the training there was more looking towards the air station. If you one had to rush out there and defend that from a parachute drop or something of Germans. And it was more looking upwards than downwards.
Were you still building defences?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had trenches. And you were scattered. You weren't all in Hafnarfjörður. My company was down by the beach.
Which company had you at this time? Which company had you?
A Company.
You're back with A Company.
You're still with A Company. And then I moved to Headquarter Company later, and a man called Smallwood took over my company, my second in command. And from headquarters company. By that time, I was made an acting major, and I was a major for the rest of the time in Iceland. And
what job did you take over? You took over command of headquarters company, did you?
Yeah.
And how was a headquarters company organized?
Oh, like any other headquarters company, with signals and we had a support company with mortars, etc. Signals and the administrative staff, QM's part, and that sort of thing, PRI, welfare. And Smallwood took over my company. And then there was a support company with the mortars, carriers, and pioneers, etc. And then there was a band we got together by that time, Shakespeare Band, which had been in France, but had been captured most of it. But they got instruments back when they got home, when they brought it out with them, which was a morale raiser. Right. I got on very well with my old company, Second in Command, Smallwood, who had been an 8th Battalion officer before the war, and he was quite a senior. He became a major. And then my second in command, one of the platoon commanders, Johnson, Pat Johnson, had been on the course at Aldershot. So he was very much joined up just before the war. And then there were two OCTU officers who had come straight from OCTU, quite reasonable officers. And up in the headquarters company was Colonel Ware commanding this Major Murray, Sheriff, second in command. And Hamilton was the adjutant, who became Sir Dennis Hamilton later, a great friend of Monty. And
Were all these good officers? Would you put them high?
Most of them. We had one or two wild ones. One or two we had to get rid of, but only a few.
What kind of things were they doing to make them have to go?
Well, they couldn't command men. For instance, there was one called Ferguson Innes who wasn't with us. He was the 10th. And he couldn't command men, so he went as a sort of assistant commandant at the DF headquarters and never looked back, because he went up on the staff and got to the junior staff college. Then we had staff courses to train people to go to the staff college, junior staff college, and that sort of thing. And so it went on through the summer. We saw the midnight sun. I was lucky enough to see that. Came up and never went down. And then we moved. The Americans started coming into the war, and they started coming to Iceland. And we moved into Reykjavik, and they took over from us there. And we went back in the end of 41 and landed at Pembroke Dock on Christmas Day, 41.
And where did you go to then?
We went to... there were barracks there. We were there for quite a time, and then the whole DIV went back and handed the island over to the Americans. And the DIV was stationed in South Wales. We were actually at Pembroke Dock in the barracks for about 5 weeks, and then we went to do mountain warfare. We were going to become a mountain warfare division near Pontypool, near Usk. And we did that in billets for 6 weeks. And we were issued with mules, and we practiced rural mountain warfare as taught on the frontier, picketing hills, going along. And we had mules, mule company, and officers had, company commanders had charges, and the soldiers walked, and we walked for miles and miles and miles and got fit. Then we went back to South Wales because they decided another division, 52 Div, was going to be a mountain division. So we stopped being a mountain division.